Okay, and I'd like to introduce our speaker today who will speak until 10:10 and then answer any questions from the audience. Let's all welcome Shantae from Tustin.
Hi, I'm Shantae. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Shantae.
Wow. So try not to wear too much eye makeup because I cry a lot. And my sobriety date is May 3rd, 1999. I have a sponsor who God moved to California the year before I did, which was really cool. I'm from Naples, Florida, is where I've been living since about 1985 when I graduated from high school. Prior to that, I grew up in the Midwest in Illinois. And prior to that, I was born in San Bernardino. So I am a California born. And so when my mom met my dad, my biological father, she met him, I think, in Long Beach. And he was in the Navy. And they got together and they had three kids real quick. And then my dad got involved in a lot of drugs and he was working in New Mexico, and he was in Vegas, and he was going back and forth, and he got a new girlfriend, and off he went. So he was a heroin addict. He was 26 years old when they found him dead in a hotel room in Vegas. I was already about 2.5 years old. My mother had already remarried and moved us to Illinois by the time this all happened. And really funny, my mom's just like trying to find old divorce and marriage licenses and all this stuff, and she's now realizing I don't think she never legally divorced my dad. And it's just like, of course not. It's just my crazy family. My mom's like going, didn't he do it? And my cousin's like, he was high. I don't think, you know, a heroin addict's really following through on paperwork. You know, it's like, yeah, I don't think so, Mom. And she's like, oh, I don't really remember doing the paperwork. And it's so funny. So that's kind of a new crazy chapter for our family's book that should be written. But my mom married my stepdad who raised me, and he was an alcoholic also. He was a very functioning, hardworking, emotionally unavailable, but a good provider. And they would divorce when I was about 13 and a half, 14 years old. And we lived in a real small town. We ended up building a home and living in a little tiny town of 500 people. And I went to school with 13 kids in my class, pretty much from third grade to my freshman year. I was class president, which I know is very impressive, a class of 13. And I did have to beat Brad Lee, though. I beat him, and I think I actually, like, said that to him on Facebook not too long ago, too. But we lived in this little tiny town for a long time, and I remember my mother being really, you know, talking about being in so much culture shock of moving to the Midwest, because my mother's Mexican, and if you move to central Illinois, she's about the darkest skinned person that was allowed in that town, and I do mean allowed. People used to go into the bar where she worked just to peek their head in to see her, because she was so dark skinned, and they couldn't believe that somebody like that was actually working behind a bar, you know, serving beer to people. To all those white people. And it was interesting, and I really didn't kind of grasp onto it till I moved to Southern California. Now I go, oh, now I get it, Mom. Boy, what a culture shock, you know, because she just blends here, right? So I was like, good Lord, I can imagine what that must have been like for her. And then I could. I know what it feels like to feel different, to not feel like you fit in. And I kind of started to feel like that a lot my parents divorced and we moved. We moved from that little tiny town where it was really safe and I was a good kid and I got good grades and, you know, I was in all the sports and we moved to the next town over. My parents split up and it was due to alcoholism, my father severely beating my mother on a couple of occasions and that marriage just dissolving due to the alcoholism and the drugs. My parents were pot smokers from day one. I mean, it was funny, a guy from Zigzag, Oregon was in my home group the other day, and I thought about that brand Zigzag. Like, I've known what that brand was before I knew what, like, Mattel was or anything else, you know what I mean? Like, I knew what pot was since I've known what milk was all my whole life. The smell of it, the everything about it, you know, what little boxes it was hidden in, and, you know, what are those little one hitters? I mean, everything from when I was a little girl. It was just part of our life. And my mom used to say, your dad can't take a crap without his hitter box, you know, and it was so true. I mean, my dad was just a constant smoker, and he would do pretty much anything you give him, too, and drinker. But anyway, just, you know, that was our life, though. You know, my dad was, like I said, he was a good provider and everything, and we had a nice house and everything growing up. And then the divorce happened, and we moved to this new town. And the first night we moved to that town, my brother was selling pot in that town a lot, so a lot of kids knew him. And he had a keg of beer for his buddies, and we were moving some stuff into the house, and it was the first night we were going to stay there. And the kid up the street had a party, and it got busted. So they just took their keg and brought it down. They're like, hey, Billy Hyde just moved in down the street. Let's go down there. And my sister and I walked in, and we're in our little pom-pom uniforms, you know, from Green Valley, which is the little town we lived in. And there's like 64 kids in our house, you know, and a keg of beer. And that was it. You know, it was on. Put a keg of beer, keg up in my hand, and that was it. I don't remember how that night ended. I know I blacked out for sure. And that was my high school life for the rest of my high school years. It was a keg party. It was every weekend. It was kids at our house all the time. Kids would run away. They would come to our house. It just was the party house. I was telling somebody the other day, I feel like I need to like write an amends on my Pekin High School website on Facebook and say, I'm sorry to all the parents, you know, whose children's alcoholism and drugs we've, you know, were part of and promoting. But, you know, they would have found it somewhere. I know it wasn't just my house, but that's what our house was. People knew it. And talk about feeling different. You know, I knew the kids' parents didn't want them hanging around us, you know, we just knew it. And that was that. I mean, it was just, that's just the way it was. And I graduated and I moved to Florida when I was 18, 2 days after I turned 18. And my boyfriend from high school ran the bars and ran the hottest nightclub in Fort Myers, Florida. And, you know, I was allowed to live there in the summertime during my high school years. I was 16 and I got to go to Florida and live with him and his mom. And I was all dressed up, and I was sitting on a bar stool at the Brown Derby with a whiskey sour in my hand, 16 years old to look 19, you know, because that was the drinking age. So drinking for me, the way it was all about being grown up and having the right to drink, and I thought it was really cool, and I liked it, and I liked everything that was cool about it, and I didn't really ever think it was a problem. I did not have any idea that my drinking was a problem. The way you were thinking about me, the way you were treating me, the way you were living, the way you were acting was a problem. And if you just didn't do that, you know, maybe I wouldn't need a drink. I don't know. That's just kind of, I had my finger pointing at everybody. I wasn't like my sister. She was really bad. You know, I could compare and, you know, rationalize my drinking. And I didn't ever, ever know I was an alcoholic until I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would get married and divorced by the time I was 22. I dated a guy for like 5 years. He never wanted to really get married or have babies, so I broke up with him, quit my job, and moved like in a month. In hindsight, I would understand that that's kind of alcoholic behavior, I guess. And then I met my husband, and we got married. We've been married now. Next month, it'll be 15 years. And when I met him and dated him for a while and broke up with him, I said, I would never marry somebody like him. He is just a control freak, and screw him. And I didn't want to date him anymore, and I broke up with him and moved on with my life for about a year. And then, you know, we stayed friends, and I would end up marrying him. And a year into our marriage, I was just suffering again with this not enoughness and not feeling good enough. And throughout the years, I had gone to adult children of alcoholics meetings. I had been going to Al-Anon off and on, popping in once in a while since I was 19 years old because my sister was an alcoholic and I was afraid she was going to die and I needed to figure out how to save her. So I went to Al-Anon, and then I didn't really like what they had to say. So then I left, and, you know, I've been looking for a way to fix the not enoughness and the self-esteem problem I've had for a really long time. And that was my goal, you know, because I wanted to keep it together. Because my life looked nice. You know, I had a nice looking life. I had two golden retrievers and a nice little house on a golf course in Florida. And, you know, I was a mentor to children, and I worked for an organization that mentored children, and I matched you up with your little, you know, child you were going to mentor, and I did public speaking and recruited people to mentor children, and all of this absolutely was a lot of reasons why I just could not be an alcoholic. And actually, I never even thought, am I an alcoholic? Ever. Until I went to a therapist one morning and said, you know, here's my poor sad story and my alcoholic fathers. And 3 years into this, prior to my sobriety date, my father, who raised me, jumped off a bridge and killed himself due to this disease. Caterpillar Tractor Company, who he worked for, went on strike. And you give any, you know, hardworking workaholic, alcoholic, all that time on their hands, and things are going to progress. So he killed himself, and I think it was from that time on my drinking did progress more. But a year into my marriage, I just really needed to figure out how I could quit feeling like the, you know, I always said, like, my husband was the Jolly Green Giant and I was that little sprout. That's how I always felt. And, you know, I wanted this thing to work, and I just, God, you know, I just want to fix this self-esteem problem. And I've been going to therapy, to this really nice therapist, and she's like, you know, your insurance isn't covering this. I'm going to cut your bill in half. You pay me half, but you need to find a new therapist that's on your insurance. So I did. But the night before my new therapy appointment was the Taste of Collier, which is like Taste of the Town, and you go, and I was just going to go down there after church. My husband was coming back in from out of town, and I was just going down, have a beer, and grab a bite to eat real quick, and go home and get the house ready for my husband to come home. And that was about 11 o'clock. So about 7:30 p.m., I'm walking back to my car on the phone going, hey, babe, I'm on my way home. Guess who I ran into at McCabe's? Because, of course, I ended up in the bar, you know, after the whole thing was over, and I was serving beer and drinking beer with one of the clubs I belonged to. And, you know, my whole plan, which I had a lot of those, was just to have a couple. Didn't work out again. And my husband said, I don't know where you are, but sit down and don't move. Tell me where your car is. I'm coming to get you. And I was like, oh man, I'm in so much trouble. This is the way I used to feel all the time. Oh shit. He is going to be so on my ass. And I'm so much, I'm in trouble. And that's how I used to always feel. Like, I'm the little kid and he's the dad and I'm in trouble. And I hated that. And I resented him for that. How dare he make me feel that way? You know, I was so sick of that crap. And, so he picked me up. The next morning was like a lot of mornings. I wanted to hurry up, get out of there, get dressed before he had said two words to me and just be on my way. And, you know, I'm thinking back, I'm like, I don't even remember, like, how did I get my car? I don't even remember that, how I even got out of there to go to the therapy appointment. But I must have had an extra car that day or something. But, so I go to the therapist, and I'm telling her my whole story about, you know, my drug addict biological father, my stepdad, my mom. You know, my mom wasn't an addict. My mom just loves to marry them. And, you know, my sister who, like, just got out of prison because she was on meth and da-da-da. And then, you know, my brother who's a pothead, and my little brother who's a complete full-blown alcoholic and don't know where he is, and, you know, telling her my whole sad story, and that, you know, and last night I went down to the Taste of the Town, blah, 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 tell her the whole story. She's like, okay, well, our hour's up, and I'm going to just suggest that you go to an AA meeting. And I wanted to say, you lady, I'm like, didn't you just hear what I just told you? No, my whole family, they're the ones with the problem. I just need to fix my self-esteem issue. I'm like, and I just start bawling, you know, because I think somewhere in me, maybe I knew it was true, but I was pissed and I was in denial. And I went back to my office, and my best friend and I worked out. I'm like, can you believe this woman? And I went home and I told my husband, can you believe this woman? And my husband looked at me and went, Shantae, I'm always telling you, you really shouldn't have more than a couple glasses of wine. You know, because that's my husband. Even to this day, like 13 years later, he goes, she hasn't even had one glass of wine. You know, like he doesn't get it, but that's okay. And I said, so when he said that to me, like, oh my God, Shantae, you know, I've been telling you, you shouldn't really have more than one glass of wine or two glasses of wine. In that moment, I had this moment of clarity of like, oh my God, I'm putting him on eggshells, you know? And I hated that. You know, I hated living on those eggshells. I lived on those fucking eggshells my whole life. It sucks. And I hated that. I never wanted to do that to somebody else. But that was fleeting. That went away. And I was like, we're going on vacation. I'm not going to AA. I'm like, I'm going to Sedona. So we went to Sedona. And I was very, I said, I'll show this bitch, you know? I was so careful. So I was in denial, right? Then I went to Sedona for a couple days. I was controlling it. We're going to stop on our, so, but we go to Sedona to visit these friends of ours who are like the biggest partiers we know. They got more money than God because he's like this major pot dealer. And they don't show up with like, you know, whatever, a one hitter box full of pot. They show up with like this pipe with a bowl like this big, and they don't show up with a bottle of champagne. They show up with a magnum of champagne in a cooler in this SUV. And then, you know, and so on. So it's like, oh my God. So we get in there and we stop for gin and tonics on the way home, and I'm real careful. And then the next night it's dinner and wine, and I'm real careful. And then the next night, that was all she wrote. You know, we were up, we started popping bottles of champagne, and my husband went to bed, and we're like, party pooper. So we stay up, and I don't know how many of you have a picture of your last blackout, but I do. I'm sitting on their fireplace, and there's a picture of me, and I still have this picture to this day. I'm in a complete blackout, and I all I remember is we were playing music, and it was really loud, and apparently what I don't remember is that I went downstairs and like bitched at my husband because he was being such a party pooper, I guess, and came back upstairs. Don't remember any of it. All I remember is waking up the next morning in my clothes on their couch going, oh, my God. I did it again. And I went, shit. So I threw on my running clothes to go for a jog because I figure if I go for a jog, then he sees me jogging, he's going to think, oh, she wasn't that loaded because I don't remember bitching him out in the middle of my drunken, you know, blackout. So I go for this run and I'm running and I'm in Sedona. And if you've ever been there, it's like all these red rocks, right? And I climb like up this wall thing and I'm sitting, there's this big red rock on the side of the road, and I just sit down and I'm just freaking out because when I woke up, my husband was gone and his ex-wife lived in Tucson. So I'm convinced he's gone to Tucson. I'm screwed. He's left me. He's gone back to her. And he has every reason to, you know, because once again, I'm such a fucking loser. And, God, I was just so freaked out. Everything, you know, it's just like the movie, you know, it all starts flashing back at you. And I'm like, oh my God. And then, you know, I was just crying and crying and just falling apart. And I was just like, oh my God, please help me. And that was my bottom, you know, that was it. And I went back to the house, and my friends and I, we went to church. Oh my God, I was so hungover. I was still drunk. I was so dehydrated. I remember I got up like 7 times just to go get a drink of water. Anyway, my husband got back to the house, and I looked at him, and I said, listen, don't say anything to me, please. You couldn't hate me more than I hate myself right now. And when we get home, I'm going to AA. I'd met a girl at an ACOA meeting years before. We had the same hairdresser. God knew what he was doing. We became kind of friends. I called her up. Can you take me to a meeting? She said, yeah. I walked in the door. I went to the meeting. I was crying my eyes out, and you guys were talking about exactly how I felt. And you guys were talking about filling that hole. And it was stuff that I felt my whole life, but I never really put into those words. But I completely related. And I wasn't really thrilled about that because I certainly didn't want to hang out with all you losers. I was like, I had hit bottom by showing up in AA, is what I thought. And I was very judgmental. And a very lovely woman told me right away, which saved my ass, which was, do not compare, but identify. And I've done that for 13 years. And I was told to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and get a sponsor and work the steps. And I've done that. And 100 days sober, I moved to Connecticut. My husband and I moved. And I did 90 and 90 again. And I got connected in AA. And I sponsored women about 5 years in. And that's when a lot of my personal growth happened in this program. I found a God of my understanding. I thought God was this guy that sat on a big cloud with a big to-do list for the whole world and no time for me. So I found out that that wasn't true. And I found out how to have some faith and trust. And then we moved to California a year ago, and I really learned how to trust. And I'm still practicing that on a daily basis. But where I lived, I could go anywhere in town and probably run into a couple people I know. Here I go around all day, and I don't see a single person I know unless I show up at a meeting. And then sometimes I don't know anybody there either, you know. And it's really hard, you know, to kind of go around where everybody knows your name, and then all of a sudden, you know, like talk about anonymity. Ugh, California, you guys, so many people here. And it's been hard for me. I thought it was going to be this great adventure, and it is, but it's been very difficult to feel at home. This is where I do feel at home in every meeting I'm in, thank God. I've worked this program to the best of my ability. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. Who her sponsor lives in Cyprus. How about that? We all end up in California. It's really weird. And I sponsor women, and that helps me so much. I don't know how good of a sponsor I am, but I just do what I can. You know, I try to tell them I don't tell you to do anything my sponsor, you know, didn't tell me to do, and that's all I got. But, you know, one of the greatest gifts of sobriety was being sober a year in and getting pregnant and having my son, who's never seen me drink, who's awesome and says, Mommy, I want to go to Alateen because I don't want to be an alcoholic, you know, and who sees my brother drinking in front of him on our recent trip to Florida and looks at me and goes, gosh, Mommy, I hope Uncle Jason quits drinking. And who knows about my best friend relapsing and she and I finally talking again. And he, first thing my little boy says to me, is she going to meetings, Mommy? You know, and that's a gift. This kid gets it, you know. And so if he gets it for real, he knows where to go. And because he's super sensitive, I see how sensitive he is, and I'm going, oh my God, he's an alcoholic already, I know it. You know, but he's in God's hands, I know that. And a week ago Thursday, one of my best friends died. OD'd on coke, had a heart attack, 45 years old. You know, they buried him yesterday, and I couldn't be there. And he has an 18-year-old son and 11-year-old little girl. He was a great guy that never grew up. You know, like that Peter Pan syndrome. He was partying just like we did in high school, you know. And but he was a great guy. But the reality of my journey in to Alcoholics Anonymous is that this is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And this will kill you if you want to fuck around with this. If you don't take it seriously. And the hardest part is those people that never find it, never even walk in these doors to even like hear about it and get it. You know, that contempt prior to investigation should be tattooed on my brother's forehead, you know. He just doesn't think this is going to work for him, you know. He's never been in these rooms. And it's a shame. But one thing I know is that I am powerless, man. I am powerless over alcohol. I am powerless over your alcohol. You know, I can't do anything. I can't make it up to those kids that partied at my house, and I can't get my brother sober, and I can't bring these dead people back to life, you know. I can just stay sober one day at a time, you know, and be available to somebody that reaches their hand out to me. That's all I can do. I teach fitness for a living, and my sponsor was saying to me the other day, you know, what if Kim is my husband. What if Kim died yesterday? What are you going to do with your life? You know, Shantae, you know, two fitness classes a day isn't going to pay your bills. You know, so she want me to kind of think, you know, it was just one of, and I figured out what I want to be when I grow up, and I'm going to do that as soon as I know what direction my family's going in. We're looking at an opportunity in Atlanta, Georgia right now. We might be moving. Talk about trusting God and trying to stay present and in this moment, thinking about moving again. I mean, you know, I want to pack last week, you know, and get it ready and get going. And I don't know. I don't know if it's going to happen, you know. So I've really got the opportunity to practice these principles in all my affairs and just do the next indicated step, do the next thing that's in front of me, because I really want to know what the hell's going on. I want to know yesterday. And I don't know what that is. But when I do finally settle in to wherever I'm going, you know, I know that I want to do something in the field of counseling for drugs and alcohol, you know. I don't really like to go to school and I don't want to study. But the only thing that I really truly have any passion about or care about, I care about people being well, physically, mentally, spiritually. And if I can do something on a day-to-day basis to do that, you know, that's what I want to do. And my little boy was like, Mommy, you can go back to school. He said this to me like a month ago. I'm like, yeah, uh-huh. So, you know, that's the gift of losing my friend Rich the other day and just realizing, you know, I can do something just a little bit more. I hope. Because all of this death around me is very painful, and I have to accept it, but I can get into action, you know, one day at a time. I can say my prayers, and I can trust God, and I can go to a meeting, and I can be available to somebody else, and then maybe I can go learn a little bit more, and maybe go help other people a little bit more in another way. And that's the conclusion I've come to this week for myself, you know, and it's because of drugs and alcohol and the death of people. And so with that, I can at least be grateful, you know, that I'm alive, that I have a chance, and that I can do something more. Because I know what it's like to be those little kids today, you know, the day after having to say goodbye to their dad, you know, and to just wish you could wake up from that nightmare. But it's the truth, you know, we get locked up, covered up, or sobered up. And everybody in my family has done one or the other, you know. And today, I can just pray to God that I stay sober and do the next right thing. And I'm just eternally grateful for this program. It means the world to me. I don't know that I have I'm not even that passionate about fitness, honestly, you know, because left to my own device, I'd hire a personal trainer. I'm a personal trainer. I'd hire a personal trainer. That's how motivated I am. I'm more motivated about this than anything, I think, because this disease is taking people I love, but it's also helping me have a lot of people in my life that I get to live with and love on a daily basis, whether I know you or not, you know, so I'm so grateful. Thank you for this opportunity to share.
Okay, so we still have time for question and answers. Sure, Shante.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing your life, your friends, and your heart. What's your approach to working step one with a brand new sponsor?
I have them write, I just say, just write me a grocery list of how drinking made your life unmanageable. I said, it doesn't have to be a big story, just like, you know, I blacked out, I slept with your brother, my boyfriend's brother, whatever, you know, I mean, like, whatever you did, you know, just a grocery list, you know, what, how was that unmanageable for you? That's what they did for me, and I still keep that list in my big book, so, yeah. Hey, Shay. Oh, that's a good question. It's amazing. I was probably, Colton was about 4 years old, I think. So I was, you know, almost six years married, and I still wasn't sure that I was wanting to be married to this guy, you know? And it was really interesting. I had a sponsor, and I'd moved. I moved when I was 100 days sober. So I moved to Connecticut, and then I moved back to Florida. So I've had different sponsors, quite a few different sponsors. And I had quite a few of them say, you might want to do a four-step on your husband, because I kept saying, well, he, that's kind of like how a lot of my conversations would start. And Colton was about 4 years old, and I was still in that place. And I got enough pain over it, and I finally did that four-step just on my husband. And I started to see my part in things. And that saved my marriage. It really did, because I was pretty, you know, it made my stomach hurt when I thought about my son without his dad, because he's a great father. He's a great person. And luckily today, I never thought that he'd be my best friend. You know, I love him. He's a good guy, but no, my girlfriends are so important to me, you know. And God brought us to California and put us in a place where we have just completely started over financially and whatnot, and been in a place that's torn up a lot of marriages. I've watched a lot of marriages fail going through what we're going through, and we've just gotten closer. And what it is that I quit taking his inventory and I own my part in things. And I realize that the way that I choose to feel when he does certain things that trigger me, it's really not about him. It reminds me of something else. You know, it reminds me of my dad. It reminds me of just certain things. And I had to learn that, you know, he loves me. He really loves me. And what you guys did is you loved me till I could love myself. And when I got to really working and doing the inventory and taking a daily inventory and really looking at my part in things and learning to love myself enough, I could accept the love that he had for me. And today he is my best friend. He's a wonderful man. I don't like everything he does, but, you know, he doesn't ever do anything to harm me. You know, he doesn't. And so it's just been working this program. It's really, that's the beauty of AA for me. You know, I don't get this anywhere else. You know, I don't get the way to live, not at church or not at anything, nowhere, just here. So, yeah. Thanks.